4. The Order Police and the Final Solution, Deportation. Just as the role of the Order Police in the massacre of Russian Jewry was beginning to wind down in the fall of 1941, the Luga took on a new and vital assignment contributing to the Final Solution, guarding the deportation trains to the east. In late September 1941, Hitler approved the commencement of Jewish deportations from the Third Reich, to be organized by Reinhard Heydrich through his Jewish expert in Berlin, Adolf Eichmann, and the regional security police offices throughout Germany. The only exceptions on the local level were in Vienna and Prague, where the deportations were to be handled by the central agencies for Jewish emigration, created by Eichmann before the war and staffed by his handpicked men. Almost immediately, Heydrich reached agreement with De Luga on a division of labor. De Luga's order police would guard the transports that Heydrich's security police organized. Before each deportation wave, the local order police were instructed to accommodate security police requests for the agreed-upon transport guards. Ordinarily, the order police supplied one officer and 15 men to each transport. What was the scale of these operations? Between the fall of 1941 and the spring of 1945, over 260 deportation trains took German, Austrian, and Czech Jews directly to the ghettos and death camps in the east, i.e. Poland and Russia, or to the transit ghetto of Theresienstadt, north of Prague, and from there to the east. A minimum of 147 trains from Hungary, 87 from Holland, 76 from France, 63 from Slovakia, 27 from Belgium, 23 from Greece, 11 from Italy, 7 from Bulgaria, and 6 from Croatia. That is, close to 450 additional trains from Western and Southern Europe were taken over by German guards at some point in their journey. No estimate has even been made of the number of Jewish deportation trains that traveled from Polish cities to the nearby death camps, but it was clearly in the many hundreds. Virtually all of these trains were guarded by order police. What did this mean in terms of what the order police experienced? One graphic report by Lieutenant Paul Saliter on guarding a deportation train from Düsseldorf to Riga on December 11, 1941, has already been published in both English and German. Two other reports on deportation trains from Vienna to Sobibor and from Kołomia in Galicia to Berzec are noteworthy for an understanding of what numerous order police units did more than 1,000 times during the war. First, the Vienna transport. 152nd Police Precinct, Vienna, June 20, 1942. Report of experiences. Subject: Transport Commando for the Jewish Transport, Vienna Aspang Bahnhof to Sobibor, June 14, 1942. The transport commando consisted of Reserve Lieutenant Fischmann as leader, two sergeants, and 13 reserve policemen of the 1st Reserve Police Company East. The duty of the transport commando began at 11 a.m. on June 14, 1942, at the Aspang Bahnhof, in accordance with the prior telephone request of SS Hauptsturmführer Brunner. 1. The loading of the Jews. Under the direction and supervision of SS Hauptsturmführer Brunner and SS Hauptscharführer Girsig of the Central Agency for Jewish Emigration, the loading of the Jews into the special train awaiting in the Aspang Bahnhof began at noon and went smoothly. The guard duty of the transport commando commenced at this time. A total of 1,000 Jews were deported. The transfer of the Jews as listed occurred at 4 p.m., because of a shortage of cars, the transport commando had to make do with a third instead of a second-class car. 2. Trip from Vienna to Sobibor. The train, DA-38, was dispatched from Vienna at 7.08 p.m. on June 14, 1942, and traveled to Sobibor, not as scheduled to Izbica via Lundenburg, Breklar, Brunn, Brno, Neisse, Nisa, Opeln, Opole, Częstochowa, Kielce, Radom, Dęblin, Lublin, and Chełm. Arrival in Sobibor on June 17, 1942, at 8.05 a.m. On arrival in Lublin at 9 p.m. on June 16, SS Obersturmführer Pohl was waiting for the train at the station, and had 51 Jews capable of work between the ages of 15 and 50 removed from the train and taken to a work camp. At the same time, he gave the order to take the remaining 949 Jews to the work camp in Sobibor. Both lists of names, 3 wagons of baggage with food supplies, as well as 100,000 zlotys, were turned over to SS Obersturmführer Pohl in Lublin. At 11 p.m., the train departed from Lublin for Sobibor. At the Jewish camp in Travniki, some 30 kilometers beyond Lublin, the 3 baggage wagons and food supplies were surrendered to SS Scharführer Meyerhofer. 3. Delivery of the Jews in Sobibor. At 8:15 a.m. on June 17th, the train drove into the work camp next to the Sobibor train station, where the camp commandant, First Lieutenant Stangl, took delivery of the 949 Jews. The unloading of the train cars began immediately and was completed by 9:15 a.m. 4. Trip from Sobibor to Vienna. The return trip in the special train began about 10 a.m., immediately after the completion of the unloading of the Jews from Sobibor to Lublin, where we arrived at 2:30 a.m. on June 18th. No travel expenses were paid for this train. The trip continued from Lublin at 8:13 a.m. on June 18th by regularly scheduled express train to Kraków, where we arrived at 5:30 p.m. on the same day. In Kraków, we billeted with the 3rd Company of Reserve Police Battalion 74. On June 19th, this company handed out one day's rations to each of the 16 men. From Kraków, the return trip was again continued on a regularly scheduled express train at 8:08 p.m. on June 19th. Arrival in Vienna East train station at 6:30 a.m. on June 20th. 5. The Transport Commando Stopover in Kraków. The stopover of the Transport Commando in Kraków lasted 26 and a half hours. 6. Crossing the border. The special train crossed the border between the Reich and the General Government on the outward journey on June 15th at 1:45 p.m., the regularly scheduled express train on the return trip at 12:15 a.m. on June 20th. 7. Provisions. The men of the Transport Commando were provided with cold rations for 4 days. This consisted of sausage, bread, marmalade, and butter, but was nonetheless not sufficient. In Kraków, the daily ration of the 3rd Company of Reserve Battalion 74 was good and sufficient. 8. Suggestions. In future, it will be necessary to provide the men of the Transport Commando with marching rations, because the cold rations do not keep in the summer months. The sausage, it was a soft sausage, was already opened and cut up when handed out on June 15th, and had to be consumed no later than the 3rd day because of the danger of spoiling. On the 4th day, the men had to be satisfied with marmalade, because the butter was also already rancid due to the tremendous heat in the train car. The size of the ration was also rather meager. 9. Incidents. No incidents occurred either on the outward journey, the stopovers in the train stations, or the return trip. Signed, Fischmann, Precinct Lieutenant of the Schutzpolizei. The deportation of largely unsuspecting Viennese Jews, most of them elderly and or female, passed with so little incident that Lieutenant Fischmann could concentrate on the hardships of a 3rd rather than 2nd class car, insufficient rations, and the summer heat that spoiled his butter. No mention, of course, was made of what the incarcerated Jews, without food or water, must have been suffering in the closed cattle cars during the 61-hour journey. But Fischmann was quite conscious, as he delivered 949 Jews to the alleged work camp in Sobibor, that the Jews selected for work, the luggage, and the food supplies, did not accompany them there. At Sobibor, the gas chambers were deep in the forest, and not visible from the unloading ramp. But contrary to most order police denials, Fischmann and his commando apparently entered the camp and watched the unloading. The order police who guarded the deportation train from Coamia in Galicia found the experience considerably more trying than the incident-free transport from Vienna. Indeed, in Galicia, where the Jews had been subjected to open-air massacres in the summer and fall of 1941, and to a first wave of deportations in the spring of 1942, the resumption of deportations in August 1942 clearly no longer entailed an unknown fate for many of the victims. In mid-September 1942, an order police captain of Reserve Police Battalion 133 in Police Regiment 24, reported on the experiences of 1 week of deportation operations. 7. Paul, 24. Lemberg, Lvov, September 14, 1942. 2. Commander of the Order Police in the District of Galicia, Lemberg. Subject, Jewish resettlement. After carrying out Jewish resettlement actions on the 3rd and 5th of September in Skole, Strich, and Khodorov, for which Captain of the Schutzpolizei Krepelin was in charge of the Order Police involved, and which has already been reported in detail, the 7th Company of the 24th Police Regiment arrived as ordered in Kołomia on the evening of September 6th. I immediately contacted Kriminalkommissar and SS Obersturmführer Leitmaritz, head of the branch office of the Security Police in Kołomia, and First Lieutenant Hertel of the Schutzpolizei station in Kołomia. Contrary to the experience in Strich, the action plan for September 7th in Kołomia was well prepared and made easy for all units involved. The Jews had been informed by the above-mentioned agencies and the Labor Office to gather at the collection point of the Labor Office for registration on September 7th at 5:30 a.m. Some 5,300 Jews were actually assembled there at the appointed time. With all the manpower of my company, I sealed the Jewish quarter and searched thoroughly, whereby some 600 additional Jews were hunted down. The loading of the transport train was completed about 7 p.m. After the security police released some 1,000 from the total rounded up, 4,769 Jews were resettled. Each car of the transport was loaded with 100 Jews. The great heat prevailing that day made the entire action very difficult and greatly impeded the transport. After the regular nailing up and sealing of all cars, the transport train got underway to Bezhets about 9 p.m., with a guard of one officer and 9 men. With the coming of deep darkness in the night, many Jews escaped by squeezing through the air holes after removing the barbed wire. While the guard was able to shoot many of them immediately, most of the escaping Jews were eliminated that night or the next day by the railroad guard or other police units. This transport was delivered in Bezhets without noteworthy incident, although given the length of the train and the deep darkness, the guard had proved to be too weak, as the commander of the transport guard from the 6th Company of Police Regiment 24, who returned directly to Stanislavov, was able to report to me in person on September 11th. On September 8th, some 300 Jews, old and weak, ill, frail, and no longer transportable, were executed. According to the order of September 4th, of which I was first informed on September 6th concerning use of ammunition, 90% of those executed were shot with carbines and rifles. Only in exceptional cases were pistols used. On September 8th and 10th, actions in Kuty, Kosov, Horodenka, Zaplatov, and Shniatin were carried out. Some 1,500 Jews had to be driven on foot marches 50 kilometers from Kuty or 35 kilometers from Kosov to Kołomia, where they were kept overnight in the courtyard of the security police prison with the other Jews brought together from the region. Other than the Jews rounded up in Horodenka and Shniatin, who had already been loaded onto 10 cars at each location by the security police, another 30 cars were loaded in Kołomia. The total number sent to Bezhets on the resettlement train of September 10th amounted to 8,205. In the actions in the area around Kołomia on September 8th and 10th, some 400 Jews had to be eliminated by shooting for the well-known reasons. In the great roundup of Jews to be resettled by September 10th in Kołomia, the security police loaded all Jews into the 30 available train cars despite the objections I expressed. Given the great heat prevailing on those days, and the strain on the Jews from the long foot marches or from waiting for days without being given any provisions worth noting, the excessively great overloading of most of the cars with 180 to 200 Jews was catastrophic in a way that had tremendously adverse effects on the transport. How densely the 10 cars each in Horodenka and Shniatin were loaded with Jews by the security police is beyond my knowledge. In any case, both transports arrived in Coamia with completely inadequate guard, so that the barbed wire closing the air holes was almost entirely removed. As quickly as possible, I had this train moved out of the train station in Coamia and coupled with the 30 cars standing on a side track far from the station. The Jewish police, Ordnungsdienst, and members of the train station construction crew from Coamia were employed until the onset of darkness to close up all the insufficiently sealed cars in the usual regulation manner. A commando of one officer and 15 men, under the leadership of Captain Zitzmann, was assigned to guard the parked resettlement train of 50 cars until departure and to prevent any escape attempt. Given the already described strains on the Jews, the negative effect of the heat, and the great overloading of most of the cars, the Jews attempted time and again to break out of the parked train cars, as darkness had already set in towards 7:30 p.m. At 7:50 p.m., the guard commando of the resettlement train, with 9 men under Corporal Jochlein, arrived at the sidetrack. Breakout attempts from the parked train could not be prevented in the darkness, nor could the escaping Jews be shot in flight. In all train cars, the Jews had completely undressed because of the heat. As the train left Coamia on schedule at 8:50 p.m., the guard took up their stations. The guard commando, as initially stipulated by me, was divided into 5 men in a passenger car at the front and 5 men in a passenger car at the end of the train. On account of the length of the train and its total load of 8,205 Jews, this distribution proved to be unsuitable. Next time, Corporal J will arrange a distribution of the guards along the entire train. Throughout the entire trip, the policemen had to remain in the cabooses in order to be able to counter the escape attempts of the Jews. Shortly into the journey, the Jews attempted to break through the sides and even through the ceilings of certain train cars. They were partially successful in perpetrating the scheme, so that already 5 stations before Stanisławów, Corporal J had to ask the station master in Stanisławów by telephone to lay out nails and boards in order to seal the damaged cars as required by orders and to request a station guard to watch the train. As the train entered Stanisławów, the train station workers and the station guards were present to carry out the necessary repairs and, in addition, take over guarding the train. The work took 1.5 hours. When the train subsequently resumed its journey, it was discovered at the next stop, some stations later, that once again large holes had been broken by the Jews in some of the train cars and that, for the most part, the barbed wire fastened on the outside of the ventilation windows had been torn off. In one train car, the Jews had even been working with hammer and saw. Upon interrogation, they explained that the security police had left these tools with them because they could make good use of them at their next workplace. Corporal J made the Jews hand over the tools. During the further journey, at every station stop, help was needed to nail up the train, because otherwise the rest of the trip would not have been at all possible. At 11:15 a.m., the train reached Lemberg. Because no relief for the escort commando arrived, the escort commando J had to continue guarding the train until Bezec. After a brief halt at the Lemberg train station, the train continued to the suburban station of Klaporov, where 9 train cars marked with the letter L and destined for the labor camp were turned over to SS Obersturmführer Schulze and unloaded. SS Obersturmführer Schulze then had some additional 1,000 Jews loaded. About 1:30 p.m., the transport departed for Bezec. With the change of engine in Lemberg, such an old engine was hooked up that further travel was possible only with continuous interruptions. The slow journey was time and again used by the strongest Jews to press themselves through the holes they had forced open and to seek their safety in flight, because in jumping from the slow-moving train they were scarcely injured. Despite the repeated requests to the engineer to go faster, this was not possible, so that the frequent stops on open stretches became increasingly unpleasant. Shortly beyond Lemberg, the commando had already shot off the ammunition they had with them and also used up a further 200 rounds that they had received from army soldiers, so that for the rest of the journey they had to resort to stones while the train was moving and to fixed bayonets when the train was stopped. The ever greater panic spreading among the Jews due to the great heat, overloading of the train cars, and stink of dead bodies. When unloading the train cars, some 2,000 Jews were found dead in the train, made the transport almost unworkable. At 6:45 p.m., the transport arrived in Bezec, and around 7:30 p.m. was turned over by Corporal J. to the SS Obersturmführer and head of the camp there. Until the unloading of the transport around 10 p.m., J. had to remain in the camp while the escort commando was used to guard the train cars parked outside the camp. Because of the special circumstances described, the number of Jews who escaped from this transport cannot be specified. Nonetheless, it can be assumed that at least 2/3 of the escaping Jews were shot or rendered harmless in some other way. In the actions themselves for the period of September 7th through 10th, 1942, no special incidents occurred. The cooperation between the security police and the order police units involved was good and without friction. Signed, Westermann, Reserve Lieutenant of the Schutzpolizei and Company Commander. This document demonstrates many things. The desperate attempts of the deported Jews to escape the death train, the scanty manpower employed by the Germans, a mere 10 men to guard over 8,000 Jews, the unimaginably terrible conditions, forced marches over many miles, terrible heat, days without food and water, the packing of 200 Jews into each train car, etc., that led to fully 25% of the deported Jews dying on the train from suffocation, heat prostration, and exhaustion, to say nothing of those killed in the shooting, which was so constant that the guards expended their entire ammunition supply as well as replenishment. The casual mention that even before the deportations, hundreds of Jews judged too old, frail, or sick to get to the train were routinely shot in each action. Moreover, the document makes clear that this action was only one among many in which members of Reserve Police Battalion 133 participated alongside the security police in Galicia during the late summer of 1942. Such documents, however, do not tell us much that we would like to know about the grassroots perpetrators of the final solution. These men were not desk murderers who could take refuge in distance, routine, and bureaucratic euphemisms that veiled the reality of mass murder. These men saw their victims face to face. Their comrades had already shot all the Jews deemed too weak to be deported, and they subsequently worked viciously for hours to prevent their victims from escaping the train and hence the gas chambers awaiting them in Bezec. No one participating in the events described in this report could have had the slightest doubt about what he was involved in, namely a mass murder program to exterminate the Jews of Galicia. But how did these men first become mass murderers? What happened in the unit when they first killed? What choices, if any, did they have, and how did they respond? What happened to the men as the killings stretched on week after week, month after month? Documents like the one on the Coamia transport give us a vivid snapshot of a single incident, but they do not reveal the personal dynamics of how a group of normal, middle-aged German men became mass murderers. For that, we must return to the story of Reserve Police Battalion 101. 5. Reserve Police Battalion 101. When Germany invaded Poland in September 1939, Police Battalion 101, based in Hamburg, was one of the initial battalions attached to a German army group and sent to Poland. Crossing the border from Oppeln in Silesia, the battalion passed through Częstochowa to the Polish city of Kielce. There it was involved in rounding up Polish soldiers and military equipment behind German lines and guarding a prisoner of war camp. On December 17, 1939, the battalion returned to Hamburg, where about 100 of its career policemen were transferred to form additional units. They were replaced by middle-aged reservists drafted in the fall of 1939. In May 1940, after a period of training, the battalion was dispatched from Hamburg to the Wartegau, one of the four regions in western Poland annexed to the Third Reich as the Incorporated Territories. Stationed first in Poznań, until late June, and then in Łódź, renamed Litzmannstadt by the victorious Germans, it carried out resettlement actions for a period of 5 months, As part of a demographic scheme of Hitler and Himmler's to Germanize these newly annexed regions, that is, to populate them with racially pure Germans, all Poles and other so-called undesirables, Jews and Gypsies, were to be expelled from the incorporated territories into central Poland. In accordance with provisions of an agreement between Germany and the Soviet Union, ethnic Germans living in Soviet territory were to be repatriated and resettled in the recently evacuated farms and apartments of the expelled Poles. The racial purification of the incorporated territories desired by Hitler and Himmler was never achieved, but hundreds of thousands of people were shoved around like so many pieces on a chessboard in pursuit of their vision of a racially reorganized Eastern Europe. The battalion's summary report boasted of its zealous participation in the resettlement. In actions night and day without pause, 100% of the battalion's strength was employed in all of the districts of the Wartegau. On the average, some 350 Polish peasant families were evacuated daily. During the peak of the evacuation period, they, the men of the battalion, could not return to quarters for 8 days and nights. The men had the opportunity to sleep only while traveling at night by truck. In the biggest action, the battalion evacuated about 900 families. On one day, with only its own forces and 10 translators. In all, the battalion evacuated 36,972 people out of a targeted 58,628. About 22,000 people escaped the evacuation by fleeing. One drafted reservist, Bruno Probst, recalled the battalion's role in these actions. "In the resettlement of the native population, primarily in the small villages, I experienced the first excesses and killings. It was always thus that with our arrival in the villages, the resettlement commission was already there. This so-called resettlement commission consisted of members of the black, uniformed, SS and SD, as well as civilians. From them we received cards with numbers. The houses of the village were also designated with the same numbers. The cards handed to us designated the houses that we were to evacuate. During the early period, we endeavored to fetch all people out of the houses without regard for whether they were old, sick, or small children. The commission quickly found fault with our procedures. They objected that we struggled under the burden of the old and sick. To be precise, they did not initially give us the order to shoot them on the spot. Rather, they contented themselves with making it clear to us that nothing could be done with such people. In two cases, I remember that such people were shot at the collection point. In the first case, it was an old man, and in the second case, an old woman. Both persons were shot not by the men, but by non-commissioned officers." Others in the battalion also remembered the resettlement actions, but no one else remembered or admitted to such violence. One policeman did recall that the battalion had provided the security police with firing squads for the execution of 100 to 120 Poles during its stay in Poznań. Following its five-month resettlement campaign, the battalion carried out pacification actions. Combing villages and woods, they caught 750 Poles who had evaded the earlier evacuations. Their task was made more difficult because even the newly arrived ethnic Germans did not always report the unauthorized presence of the Poles they had displaced, wishing to avail themselves of cheap labor. On November 28, 1940, the battalion took up guard duty around the Łódź ghetto, which had been sealed 7 months earlier at the end of April 1940, when the 160,000 Jews of Łódź were cut off from the rest of the city by a barbed wire fence. Guarding the ghetto now became the major duty of Police Battalion 101, which had a standing order to shoot, without further ado, any Jew who ignored the posted warnings and came too close to the fence. This order was obeyed. None of Battalion 101's men, however, remembered excesses such as occurred while the 1st Company of Police Battalion 61 was guarding the Warsaw ghetto. There, the company captain openly encouraged shooting at the ghetto wall. The most notorious shooters were not rotated to other duties, but were kept permanently on ghetto guard duty. The company recreation room was decorated with racist slogans, and a Star of David hung above the bar. A mark was made on the bar door for each Jew shot, and victory celebrations were reportedly held on days where high scores were recorded. Stationed outside the ghetto wire, the battalion members had more contact with the non-Jewish population than with the incarcerated Jews. Bruno Probst recalled that the guards on the thoroughfare that cut between the two halves of the Łódź ghetto occasionally amused themselves by setting their watches ahead as a pretext for seizing and beating Poles who were allegedly violating the curfew. He also recalled that drunken guards, intending to kill a Pole on New Year's Eve, shot an ethnic German by mistake and covered it up by switching the victim's identity card. In May 1941, the battalion returned to Hamburg and was practically dissolved. All remaining pre-war recruits beneath the rank of non-commissioned officer were distributed to other units, and the ranks were filled with drafted reservists. The battalion had become, in the words of one policeman, a pure reserve battalion. During the next year, from May 1941 to June 1942, the battalion was reformed and underwent extensive training. Only a few incidents from this period remained in the memories of the men. One was the bombing of Lübeck in March 1942. Four units of the battalion were sent to the damaged city immediately afterward. Another involved the deportation of Hamburg Jews. From mid-October 1941 to late February 1942, 59 transports carried more than 53,000 Jews and 5,000 Gypsies from the Third Reich to the east, in this case Łódź, Riga, Kovno, Kaunas, and Minsk. The five transports to Kovno and the first transport to Riga were massacred upon arrival. The remaining transports were not liquidated immediately. Rather, the deportees were initially incarcerated in the ghettos of Łódź, where the 5,000 Austrian Gypsies were sent, Minsk, and Riga. Four such transports that were spared immediate death came from Hamburg. The first, with 1,034 Jews, departed on October 25, 1941, for Łódź. The second, with 990 Jews, left for Minsk on November 8. The third, with 408 Jews from Hamburg and 500 from Bremen, left for Minsk on October 18. The fourth left Hamburg for Riga with 808 Jews on December 4th. Men from Reserve Police Battalion 101 were involved in various phases of the Hamburg deportations. The collection point for the deportations was the Freemason Lodge House on the Moorweide, which had been confiscated by the security police. Flanked by the university library and an apartment block, within several hundred yards of the heavily used Domtor train station, the collection point was scarcely an inconspicuous location out of the sight of Hamburg citizens. Some order police of Battalion 101 provided guard duty at the Freemason Lodge House, where the Jews were collected, registered, and loaded on trucks to the Sternschanze train station. Other men of Battalion 101 guarded the station where the Jews were loaded onto the trains. And finally, Battalion 101 provided the escort for at least three of the four transports. The first on October 25th to Łódź, the second on November 8th to Minsk, and the last on December 4th to Riga. According to Hans Keller, escort duty on the Jewish transports was highly coveted because of the chance to travel, and was assigned only to a favored few. Bruno Probst, who accompanied the November 8th transport to Minsk, recalled, "In Hamburg, the Jews were told at the time that they would be allocated a whole new settlement territory in the east. The Jews were loaded into normal passenger cars, accompanied by two cars of tools, shovels, axes, etc., as well as large kitchen equipment. For the escort commando, a second-class carriage was attached. There were no guards in the cars of the Jews themselves. The train had to be guarded on both sides, only at stops. After about 4 days' journey, we reached Minsk in the late afternoon. We learned of this destination for the first time only during the journey, after we had already passed Warsaw. In Minsk, an SS commando was waiting for our transport. Again without guard, the Jews were then loaded onto the waiting trucks. Only their baggage, which they had been allowed to bring from Hamburg, had to be left behind in the train. They were told it would follow. Then our commando was finally driven to a Russian barracks, in which an active, i.e. not reserve, German police battalion was lodged. There was a Jewish camp nearby. From conversations with members of the above-mentioned police battalion, we learned that some weeks ago, this unit had already shot Jews in Minsk. We concluded from this fact that our Hamburg Jews were to be shot there also. Not wanting to be involved, the escort's commander, Lieutenant Hartwig Gnade, did not remain at the barracks. Instead, he and his men returned to the station and took a late-night train out of Minsk. We have no description of the escort duty to Riga from Hamburg, but the Solitaire report on the order police escort of the December 11th Jewish transport from Dusseldorf to Riga provides graphic evidence that policemen there learned as much as the Hamburg policemen did in Minsk. As Solitaire noted, Riga consisted of some 360,000 inhabitants, including some 35,000 Jews. The Jews were everywhere dominant in the business world. Their businesses were nonetheless immediately closed and confiscated after the entry of German troops. The Jews themselves were lodged in a ghetto on the Duna, Divina, that was sealed by barbed wire. At the moment, only 2,500 male Jews who are used for labor are said to be in the ghetto. The other Jews have either been sent to similar employment elsewhere or shot by the Latvians. They, the Latvians, hate the Jews in particular. From the time of liberation to the present, they have participated very amply in the extermination of these parasites. It is, however, incomprehensible to them, as I was especially able to discover from Latvian railway personnel, why the Germans bring their Jews to Latvia instead of exterminating them in their own country. In June 1942, Reserve Police Battalion 101 was assigned another tour of duty in Poland. By then, only a few non-commissioned officers who had been on the first Polish action remained, and less than 20% of the men had been on the second in the Wartegau. A few of these had witnessed what they called excesses in Poznań and Łódź. A few more had accompanied one of the Hamburg Jewish transports to Łódź, Minsk, or Riga. At the latter two destinations, as we have seen, it was difficult not to learn something about the mass murder of Jews in Russia. But for the most part, Reserve Police Battalion 101 was now composed of men without any experience of German occupation methods in Eastern Europe, or for that matter, with the exception of the very oldest, who were World War I veterans, any kind of military service. The battalion consisted of 11 officers, 5 administrative officials in charge of financial matters relating to pay, provisioning, lodging, etc., and 486 non-commissioned officers and men. To reach full strength, some non-Hamburg contingents were added at the last minute from nearby Wilhelmshaven and Rendsburg in Schleswig-Holstein, and from distant Luxembourg. Still, the vast majority of the rank and file had been born and reared in Hamburg and its environs. The Hamburg element was so dominant and the ethos of the battalion so provincial that not just the Luxembourgers, but also the contingents from Wilhelmshaven and Rendsburg felt themselves to be outsiders. The battalion was divided into 3 companies, each of approximately 140 men when at full strength. 2 companies were commanded by police captains, the third by the senior reserve lieutenant in the battalion. Each company was divided into 3 platoons, 2 of them commanded by reserve lieutenants, and the third by the platoon's senior sergeant. Each platoon was divided into 4 squads, commanded by a sergeant or corporal. The men were equipped with carbines, the non-commissioned officers with submachine guns. Each company also had a heavy machine gun detachment. Apart from the 3 companies, there was the personnel of the battalion staff, which included, in addition to the 5 administrative officials, a doctor and his aide, as well as various drivers, clerks, and communications specialists. The battalion was commanded by 53-year-old Major Wilhelm Trapp, a World War I veteran and recipient of the Iron Cross First Class. After the war, he became a career policeman and rose through the ranks. He had recently been promoted from captain of 2nd Company, and this was his first battalion command. Though Trapp had joined the Nazi Party in December 1932 and thus technically qualified as an old party fighter, or Alter Kampfer, he had never been taken into the SS or even given an equivalent SS rank, in spite of the fact that Himmler and Heydrich consciously tried to merge and intertwine the state and party components of their SS and police empire. Trapp was clearly not considered SS material. He was soon to come into conflict with his 2 captains, both young SS men, who even in their testimony more than 20 years later made no attempt to conceal their contempt for their commander as weak, unmilitary, and unduly interfering in the duties of his officers. The 2 police captains, who also held the equivalent SS rank of Hauptsturmführer, were young men in their late 20s. Wolfgang Hoffmann, born in 1914, had joined the National Socialist Student Union, NS-Schülerbund, in 1930 as a 16-year-old, the Hitler Youth in 1932 at 18, and the SS 1 year later, all before he had graduated from Gymnasium, a college preparatory high school, in 1934. He joined the police force in Breslau in 1936 and entered the Nazi Party in 1937, the same year he completed officer training and was commissioned as a lieutenant of the Schutzpolizei. He joined Reserve Police Battalion 101 in the spring of 1942. The following June, at the age of 28, he was promoted to the rank of captain. He commanded 3rd Company. Julius Wolow, born in 1913, graduated from Gymnasium in 1932. In April 1933, he joined the Nazi Party and SA. In 1936, he joined the SS, and the same year he began his training to become a police officer. He was commissioned a lieutenant of the Schutzpolizei in 1938. He too was assigned to Reserve Police Battalion 101 in early 1942, and was promoted to captain in June 1942, just before the departure for Poland. He commanded 1st Company and served as Trapp's deputy battalion commander. In contrast to the elderly Trapp, Hoffmann and Wolow represented precisely the combination of well-educated professional police officer, early enthusiast for National Socialism, and young SS member that was the Himmler-Heydrich ideal for the SS and police. Trapp's adjutant was 1st Lieutenant Hagen, about whom little is known except that he was killed in the spring of 1943. In addition, the battalion had 7 reserve lieutenants, that is, men who were not career policemen like Hoffmann and Wolow, but were selected to receive officer training after they were drafted into the order police because of their middle-class status, education, and success in civilian life. From oldest to youngest, they were Hartwig Gnade, born 1894, a forwarding agent and Nazi Party member since 1937, commander of 2nd Company. Paul Brandt, born 1902. Heinz Buchmann, born 1904, owner of a family lumber business, party member since 1937. Oskar Peters, born 1905. Walter Hoppner, born 1908, tea importer, party member briefly in 1930, rejoined in the spring of 1933. Hans Scher, born 1908, and a party member since May 1933. Kurt Drucker, born 1909, a salesman and party member since 1939. Thus, their ages ranged from 33 to 48. 5 were party members, but none belonged to the SS. Of the 32 non-commissioned officers on whom we have information, 22 were party members and 7 were in the SS. They ranged in age from 27 to 40 years old. Their average age was 33 and a half. They were not reservists, but rather pre-war recruits to the police. Of the rank and file, the vast majority were from the Hamburg area. About 63% were of working-class background, but few were skilled laborers. The majority of them held typical Hamburg working-class jobs. Dock workers and truck drivers were most numerous, but there were also many warehouse and construction workers, machine operators, seamen, and waiters. About 35% were lower middle class, virtually all of them white-collar workers. 3/4 were in sales of some sort. The other 1/4 performed various office jobs in both the government and private sector. The number of independent artisans and small businessmen was very small. Only a handful, 2%, were middle-class professionals, and very modest ones at that, such as druggists and teachers. The average age of the men was 39. Over half were between 37 and 42, a group considered too old for the army, but most heavily conscripted for reserve police duty after September 1939. Among the rank-and-file policemen, about 25%, 43 from a sample of 174, were party members in 1942. 6 were Alte Kämpfer, who had joined the party before Hitler came to power. Another 6 joined in 1933. Despite the domestic ban on new party members from 1933 to 1937, another 6 men who worked aboard ships were admitted by the party section for members living overseas. 16 joined in 1937 when the ban on new membership was lifted. The remaining 9 joined in 1939 or later. The men of lower middle class background held party membership in an only slightly higher proportion, 30%, than those from the working class, 25%. The men of Reserve Police Battalion 101 were from the lowest orders of German society. They had experienced neither social nor geographic mobility. Very few were economically independent. Except for apprenticeship or vocational training, virtually none had any education after leaving Volksschule, terminal secondary school, at age 14 or 15. By 1942, a surprisingly high percentage had become party members. However, because the interrogating officials did not record such information, we do not know how many had been communists, socialists, and/or labor union members before 1933. Presumably, a not insignificant number must have been, given their social origins. By virtue of their age, of course, all went through their formative period in the pre-Nazi era. These were men who had known political standards and moral norms other than those of the Nazis. Most came from Hamburg, by reputation one of the least Nazified cities in Germany, and the majority came from a social class that had been anti-Nazi in its political culture. These men would not seem to have been a very promising group from which to recruit mass murderers on behalf of the Nazi vision of a racial utopia free of Jews. 6. Arrival in Poland. Sometime in the summer of 1941, after the onslaught against Russian Jewry was underway, Himmler confided to the SS and police leader in Lublin, Odilo Globocznik, Hitler's intention to murder the Jews of Europe as well. Moreover, Himmler put Globocznik in charge of the single most important element of this final solution to the Jewish question in Europe, the destruction of the Jews of the general government who constituted the bulk of Polish Jewry. A method different from the firing squad operations used against Russian Jewry was deemed essential for the murder of European Jews, however, one that was more efficient, less public, and less burdensome psychologically for the killers. The organizational and technological answer to these needs was the extermination camp. The victims would be deported to special camps, where by virtue of assembly line procedures requiring very limited manpower, most of it prisoner labor, they would be gassed in relative secrecy. Preparations for gassing began at three locations in the fall of 1941, Auschwitz-Birkenau near Katowice in Silesia, and Chełmno near Łódź in the Wartegau, both in the incorporated territories, and Bezec in Globocznik's Lublin district. Large-scale gassing began at Chełmno in early December 1941 and at Birkenau in mid-February 1942. Gassing at Globocznik's camp in Bezec did not begin until mid-March 1942. The task Globocznik faced was enormous, but he was given virtually no manpower to accomplish it. For expertise and assistance in building and operating the extermination center at Bezec, Globocznik was able to draw on personnel from the euthanasia program in Germany, but this was a handful of men that, at its maximum, never exceeded 100. This number by itself was insufficient to staff a single extermination camp, and two more were yet to be built by Globocznik at Sobibor and Treblinka. But the extermination camps were not Globocznik's biggest problem. Far more pressing was the manpower required to clear the ghettos, to round up the victims and force them onto the death trains. In the Lublin district alone, there were nearly 300,000 Jews. In all of the general government, about 2 million. While Germany's military fate hung in the balance in the crucial year of 1942, where were the men for such a staggering logistical task? In fact, aside from the assignment itself, Himmler gave Globocznik virtually nothing, and he had to improvise. He had to create private armies out of his own resources and ingenuity to accomplish the task with which Himmler had entrusted him. For the coordination of the mass murder campaign against Polish Jewry, dubbed Operation Reinhard, after Reinhard Heydrich was slain in Czechoslovakia in June 1942, Globocznik formed a special staff under his deputy and fellow Austrian Hermann Höffle. The key people on this staff included Christian Wirth and his adjutant Josef Oberhauser, in charge of the extermination centers, Helmut Pohl, another Austrian, in charge of incoming transport, Georg Mischeisen, Kurt Klaassen, and yet another Austrian, Ernst Lersch, to oversee and often personally conduct operations in the field, and Georg Wippern, in charge of collecting, sorting, and utilizing the Jewish property collected at the extermination camps and in the vacated ghettos. As the SS and police leader in the Lublin district, Globocznik was responsible for coordinating all regional operations that involved the joint action of mixed SS units. Thus, the entire SS and police network in the Lublin district, though already stretched thin, was at his disposal. Most important, this meant the two branches of the security police, Gestapo and Kripo, on the one hand, and various units of the order police on the other. In addition to its main headquarters in the city of Lublin, the security police had four branch offices in the district. Each contained a Gestapo section for Jewish affairs. The presence of the order police was felt in three ways. First, each of the major towns in the Lublin district had a Schutzpolizei agency. Included in its responsibilities was the supervision of the Polish municipal police. Second, scattered throughout the towns in the countryside were small detachments of gendarmerie. Finally, three battalions of order police were stationed in the Lublin district. The security police branches, along with the Schutzpolizei and gendarmerie units, provided small numbers of policemen who knew the local conditions. But the three order police battalions, totaling 1,500 men, represented the single largest police manpower pool Globocznik could draw on. Clearly, they were indispensable, but still not sufficient to meet his needs. Globocznik also utilized two other sources of manpower. The first was the Sonderdienst, special service, composed of small units of ethnic Germans who had been mobilized and trained after the German conquest and assigned to the head of the civil administration in each county of the district in the summer of 1940. Second, and far more important, were the so-called Trawnikis. Unable to satisfy his manpower needs out of local resources, Globocznik prevailed upon Himmler to recruit non-Polish auxiliaries from the Soviet border regions. The key person on Globocznik's Operation Reinhardt staff for this task was Karl Streibel. He and his men visited the POW camps and recruited Ukrainian, Latvian, and Lithuanian volunteers, Hilfswillige, or Hivis, who were screened on the basis of their anti-communist and hence almost invariably anti-Semitic sentiments, offered an escape from probable starvation, and promised that they would not be used in combat against the Soviet army. These volunteers were taken to the SS camp at Trawniki for training. Under German SS officers and ethnic German non-commissioned officers, they were formed into units on the basis of nationality. Alongside the order police, they constituted the second major manpower pool from which Globocznik would form his private armies for the ghetto-clearing campaign. The first murderous onslaught against Lublin Jewry began in mid-March 1942 and continued until mid-April. About 90% of the 40,000 inhabitants of the Lublin ghetto were killed either through deportation to the extermination camp at Bezecz or execution on the spot, and 11,000 to 12,000 more Jews were sent to Belzec from nearby towns Izbica, Piaski, Lubartów, Zamość, and Krasnik. During the same period, some 36,000 Jews from the neighboring district of Galicia to the east of Lublin were also deported to Bezecz. From mid-April to late May, the killing operations at Bezecz were temporarily halted as the small wooden building with three gas chambers was torn down and a large stone building with six larger gas chambers was erected. When killing operations resumed at Bezecz in late May, the camp primarily received Jews deported from the neighboring district of Kraków to the west, not from the Lublin district itself. However, Sobibor, Globocznik's second extermination camp in the Lublin district, had begun operating in early May. For the next 6 weeks, it received deportations from the Lublin counties of Zamość, Puławy, Krasnistaw, and Helm. By June 18th, scarcely 3 months after the first deportation from the Lublin ghetto, about 100,000 Jews from the Lublin district had been killed, along with 65,000 from Kraków and Galicia, the vast majority by gassing at Bezecz and Sobibor. The deportations to the death camps were only part of a vast relocation of Central European Jewry. At the same time that Polish Jews were being deported from their homes to the extermination camps, trainloads of Jews from Germany, Austria, the Protectorate, and the puppet state of Slovakia were being dumped into the Lublin district. Some of these transports, such as the June 14th train from Vienna guarded by Lieutenant Fishman, were also sent directly to Sobibor. Others, however, were unloaded at various ghettos, with the foreign Jews temporarily taking the places of those who had recently been killed. This vast shuffling of Jews, as well as the mass murder in Bezec and Sobibor, stopped temporarily on June 19th, when a shortage of rolling stock brought to a halt all Jewish transports in the general government for a period of 20 days. Two death trains per week from the Kraków district to Bezec resumed on July 9th, and the steady flow of transports from Warsaw to the newly opened extermination center at Treblinka began on July 22nd. However, the main rail line to Sobibor was under repair, rendering that camp virtually inaccessible until the fall. In the Lublin district itself, therefore, deportations to the extermination camps did not resume in early July. It was during this enforced lull in the final solution in the general government that Reserve Police Battalion 101 arrived in the Lublin district. On June 20, 1942, the battalion received orders for a special action in Poland. The nature of this special action was not specified in the written orders, but the men were led to believe that they would be performing guard duty. There is no indication whatsoever that even the officers suspected the true nature of the duties that awaited them. The battalion entrained at the Sternschanze station, the same point from which some of its men had deported Hamburg Jews to the east the previous fall. It arrived in the Polish town of Zamość, in the southern part of the Lublin district, on June 25th. 5 days later, the battalion headquarters was shifted to Biłgoraj, and various units of the battalion were quickly stationed in the nearby towns of Frampol, Tarnogród, Ulanów, Turobin, and Wysokie, as well as the more distant Zakrzów. Despite the temporary lull in the killing, SS and police leader Odilo Globocznik and his Operation Reinhardt staff were not about to allow the newly arrived police battalion to remain entirely inactive in regard to the Lublin Jews. If the killing could not be resumed, the process of consolidating the victims in transit ghettos and camps could be. For most of the policemen of Reserve Police Battalion 101, the searing memory of the subsequent action in Józefów blotted out lesser events that had occurred during their four-week stay south of Lublin. However, a few did remember taking part in this consolidation process, collecting Jews in smaller settlements and moving them to larger ghettos and camps. In some cases, only so-called work Jews were seized, put on trucks, and sent to camps around Lublin. In other cases, the entire Jewish population was rounded up and put on trucks or sent off on foot. Sometimes the Jews from the smaller surrounding villages were then collected and resettled in their place. None of these actions involved mass executions, though Jews who were too old, frail, or sick to be transported were shot in at least some instances. The men were uniformly uncertain about the towns from which they had deported Jews and the places to which the Jews had been relocated. No one recalled the names Izbica and Piaski, though these were the two major transit ghettos south of Lublin that were used for collecting Jews. Apparently, Globocznik lost patience with this consolidation process and decided to experiment with renewed killing. As deportation to the extermination camps was not possible at the time, mass execution through firing squad was the available alternative. Reserve Police Battalion 101 was the unit to be tested. 7. Initiation to mass murder, the Józefów massacre. It was probably on July 11th that Globocznik or someone on his staff contacted Major Trapp and informed him that Reserve Police Battalion 101 had the task of rounding up the 1,800 Jews in Józefów, a village about 30 kilometers slightly south and east of Biłgoraj. This time, however, most of the Jews were not to be relocated. Only the male Jews of working age were to be sent to one of Globocznik's camps in Lublin. The women, children, and elderly were simply to be shot on the spot. Trapp recalled the units that were stationed in nearby towns. The battalion reassembled in Biłgoraj on July 12th, with two exceptions. The 3rd Platoon of 3rd Company, including Captain Hoffmann, stationed in Zakhshuv, as well as a few men of 1st Company already stationed in Yuzefov. Trapp met with 1st and 2nd Company commanders, Captain Volav and Lieutenant Gnade, and informed them of the next day's task. Trapp's adjutant, 1st Lieutenant Hagen, must have informed other officers of the battalion, for Lieutenant Heinz Buchmann learned from him the precise details of the pending action that evening. Buchmann, then 38 years old, was the head of a family lumber business in Hamburg. He had joined the Nazi Party in May 1937. Drafted into the Order Police in 1939, he had served as a driver in Poland. In the summer of 1940, he applied for a discharge. Instead, he was sent to officer training and commissioned as a reserve lieutenant in November 1941. He was given command of the 1st Platoon of 1st Company in 1942. Upon learning of the imminent massacre, Buchmann made clear to Hagen that as a Hamburg businessman and reserve lieutenant, he would in no case participate in such an action in which defenseless women and children are shot. He asked for another assignment. Hagen arranged for Buchmann to be in charge of the escort for the male work Jews who were to be selected out and taken to Lublin. His company captain, Volav, was informed of Buchmann's assignment, but not the reason for it. The men were not officially informed, other than that they would be awakened early in the morning for a major action involving the entire battalion. But some had at least a hint of what was to come. Captain Volav told a group of his men that an extremely interesting task awaited them the next day. Another man, who complained that he was being left behind to guard the barracks, was told by his company adjutant, "Be happy that you don't have to come. You'll see what happens." Sergeant Heinrich Steinmetz warned his men of 3rd Platoon, 2nd Company, that he didn't want to see any cowards. Additional ammunition was given out. One policeman reported that his unit was given whips, which led to rumors of a Judenaktion. No one else, however, remembered whips. Departing from Biłgoraj around 2 a.m., the truck convoy arrived in Yuzefów just as the sky was beginning to lighten. Trapp assembled the men in a half circle and addressed them. After explaining the battalion's murderous assignment, he made his extraordinary offer. Any of the older men who did not feel up to the task that lay before them could step out. Trapp paused, and after some moments, one man from 3rd Company, Otto Julius Schimke, stepped forward. Captain Hoffmann, who had arrived in Yuzefów directly from Zakhshuv with the 3rd Platoon of 3rd Company and had not been part of the officers' meetings in Biłgoraj the day before, was furious that one of his men had been the first to break ranks. Hoffmann began to berate Schimke, but Trapp cut him off. After he had taken Schimke under his protection, some 10 or 12 other men stepped forward as well. They turned in their rifles and were told to await a further assignment from the major. Trapp then summoned the company commanders and gave them their respective assignments. The orders were relayed by the 1st Sergeant Kammer to 1st Company and by Gnade and Hoffmann to 2nd and 3rd Companies. Two platoons of 3rd Company were to surround the village. The men were explicitly ordered to shoot anyone trying to escape. The remaining men were to round up the Jews and take them to the marketplace. Those too sick or frail to walk to the marketplace, as well as infants and anyone offering resistance or attempting to hide, were to be shot on the spot. Thereafter, a few men of 1st Company were to escort the work Jews who had been selected at the marketplace, while the rest of 1st Company was to proceed to the forest to form the firing squads. The Jews were to be loaded onto the battalion trucks by 2nd Company and 3rd Platoon of 3rd Company and shuttled from the marketplace to the forest. After making the assignments, Trapp spent most of the day in town, either in a schoolroom converted into his headquarters, at the homes of the Polish mayor and the local priest, at the marketplace, or on the road to the forest. But he did not go to the forest itself or witness the executions. His absence there was conspicuous. As one policeman bitterly commented, "Major Trapp was never there. Instead, he remained in Yuzefów because he allegedly could not bear the sight. We men were upset by that and said we couldn't bear it either." Indeed, Trapp's distress was a secret to no one. At the marketplace, one policeman remembered hearing Trapp say, "Oh God, why did I have to be given these orders?" as he put his hand on his heart. Another policeman witnessed him at the schoolhouse. Today I can still see exactly before my eyes Major Trapp there in the room, pacing back and forth with his hands behind his back. He made a downcast impression and spoke to me. He said something like, "Man, such jobs don't suit me, but orders are orders." Another man remembered vividly how Trapp, finally alone in our room, sat on a stool and wept bitterly. The tears really flowed. Another also witnessed Trapp at his headquarters. Major Trapp ran around excitedly and then suddenly stopped dead in front of me, stared, and asked if I agreed with this. I looked him straight in the eye and said, "No, Herr Major." He then began to run around again and wept like a child. The doctor's aide encountered Trapp weeping on the path from the marketplace to the forest and asked if he could help. He answered me only to the effect that everything was very terrible. Concerning Yusefov, Trapp later confided to his driver, "If this Jewish business is ever avenged on earth, then have mercy on us Germans." While Trapp complained of his orders and wept, his men proceeded to carry out the battalion's task. The non-commissioned officers divided some of their men into search teams of two, three, or four, and sent them into the Jewish section of Yusefov. Other men were assigned as guards along the streets leading to the marketplace or at the marketplace itself. As the Jews were driven out of their houses and the immobile were shot, the air was filled with screams and gunfire. As one policeman noted, it was a small town and they could hear everything. Many policemen admitted seeing the corpses of those who had been shot during the search, but only two admitted having shot. Again, several policemen admitted having heard that all the patients in the Jewish hospital or old people's home had been shot on the spot, though no one admitted having actually seen the shooting or taken part. The witnesses were least agreed on the question of how the men initially reacted to the problem of shooting infants. Some claimed that along with the elderly and sick, infants were among those shot and left lying in the houses, doorways, and streets of the town. Others, however, stressed quite specifically that in this initial action, the men still shied from shooting infants during the search and clearing operation. One policeman was emphatic that among the Jews shot in our section of town, there were no infants or small children. I would like to say that almost tacitly, everyone refrained from shooting infants and small children. In Yusefov, as later, he observed, "Even in the face of death, the Jewish mothers did not separate from their children. Thus, we tolerated the mothers taking their small children to the marketplace in Yusefov." Another policeman likewise noted that tacitly, the shooting of infants and small children was avoided by almost all the men involved. "During the entire morning, I was able to observe that when being taken away, many women carried infants in their arms and led small children by the hand." According to both witnesses, none of the officers intervened when infants were brought to the marketplace. Another policeman, however, recalled that after the clearing operation, his unit, 3rd Platoon, 3rd Company, was reproached by Captain Hoffmann. "We had not proceeded energetically enough." As the roundup neared completion, the men of 1st Company were withdrawn from the search and given a quick lesson in the gruesome task that awaited them. They were instructed by the battalion doctor and the company's first sergeant. One musically inclined policeman, who frequently played the violin on social occasions along with a doctor who played a wonderful accordion, recalled, "I believe that at this point all officers of the battalion were present, especially our battalion physician, Dr. Schoenfelder. He now had to explain to us precisely how we had to shoot in order to induce the immediate death of the victim. I remember exactly that for this demonstration, he drew or outlined the contour of a human body, at least from the shoulders upward, and then indicated precisely the point on which the fixed bayonet was to be placed as an aiming guide." After 1st Company had received instructions and departed for the woods, Trapp's adjutant Hagen presided over the selection of the work Jews. The head of a nearby sawmill had already approached Trapp with a list of 25 Jews who worked for him, and Trapp had permitted their release. Through an interpreter, Hagen now called for craftsmen and able-bodied male workers. There was unrest as some 300 workers were separated from their families. Before they had been marched out of Yusefov on foot, the first shots from the woods were heard. After the first salvos, a grave unrest grew among these craftsmen, and some of the men threw themselves upon the ground weeping. It had to have become clear to them at this point that the families they had left behind were being shot. Lieutenant Buchmann and the Luxembourgers in First Company marched the workers a few kilometers to a country loading station on the rail line. Several train cars, including a passenger car, were waiting. The work Jews and their guards were then taken by train to Lublin, where Buchmann delivered them to a camp. According to Buchmann, he did not put them in the notorious concentration camp at Majdanek, but in another camp instead. The Jews were not expected, he said, but the camp administration was glad to take them. Buchmann and his men returned to Biłgoraj the same day. Meanwhile, First Sergeant Kammer had taken the initial contingent of shooters in First Company to a forest several kilometers from Józefów. The trucks halted on a dirt road that ran along the edge, at a point where a pathway led into the woods. The men climbed down from their trucks and waited. When the first truckload of 35 to 40 Jews arrived, an equal number of policemen came forward, and face to face were paired off with their victims. Led by Kammer, the policemen and Jews marched down the forest path. They turned off into the woods at a point indicated by Captain Wolof, who busied himself throughout the day selecting the execution sites. Kammer then ordered the Jews to lie down in a row. The policemen stepped up behind them, placed their bayonets on the backbone above the shoulder blades as earlier instructed, and on Kammer's orders, fired in unison. In the meantime, more policemen of the First Company had arrived at the edge of the forest to fill out a second firing squad. As the first firing squad marched out of the woods to the unloading point, the second group took their victims along the same path into the woods. Wolof chose a site a few yards farther on so that the next batch of victims would not see the corpses from the earlier execution. These Jews were again forced to lie face down in a row, and the shooting procedure was repeated. Thereafter, the pendulum traffic of the two firing squads in and out of the woods continued throughout the day. Except for a midday break, the shooting proceeded without interruption until nightfall. At some point in the afternoon, someone organized a supply of alcohol for the shooters. By the end of a day of nearly continuous shooting, the men had completely lost track of how many Jews they had each killed. In the words of one policeman, it was in any case a great number. When Trapp first made his offer early in the morning, the real nature of the action had just been announced, and time to think and react had been very short. Only a dozen men had instinctively seized the moment to step out, turn in their rifles, and thus excuse themselves from the subsequent killing. For many, the reality of what they were about to do, and particularly that they themselves might be chosen for the firing squad, had probably not sunk in. But when the men of First Company were summoned to the marketplace, instructed in giving a neck shot, and sent to the woods to kill Jews, some of them tried to make up for the opportunity they had missed earlier. One policeman approached First Sergeant Kammer, whom he knew well. He confessed that the task was repugnant to him, and asked for a different assignment. Kammer obliged, assigning him to guard duty on the edge of the forest, where he remained throughout the day. Several other policemen who knew Kammer well were given guard duty along the truck route. After shooting for some time, another group of policemen approached Kammer and said they could not continue. He released them from the firing squad and reassigned them to accompany the trucks. Two policemen made the mistake of approaching Captain and SS Hauptsturmführer Wolof instead of Kammer. They pleaded that they too were fathers with children and could not continue. Wolof curtly refused them, indicating that they could lie down alongside the victims. At the midday pause, however, Kammer relieved not only these two men, but a number of other older men as well. They were sent back to the marketplace, accompanied by a non-commissioned officer who reported to Trapp. Trapp dismissed them from further duty and permitted them to return early to the barracks in Biłgoraj. Some policemen who did not request to be released from the firing squads sought other ways to evade. Non-commissioned officers armed with submachine guns had to be assigned to give so-called mercy shots, because both from excitement as well as intentionally, individual policemen shot past their victims. Others had taken evasive action earlier. During the clearing operation, some men of First Company hid in the Catholic priest's garden until they grew afraid that their absence would be noticed. Returning to the marketplace, they jumped aboard a truck that was going to pick up Jews from a nearby village in order to have an excuse for their absence. Others hung around the marketplace because they did not want to round up Jews during the search. Still others spent as much time as possible searching the houses so as not to be present at the marketplace where they feared being assigned to a firing squad. A driver assigned to take Jews to the forest made only one trip before he asked to be relieved. "Presumably, his nerves were not strong enough to drive more Jews to the shooting site," commented the man who took over his truck and his duties of chauffeuring Jews to their death. After the men of First Company departed for the woods, Second Company was left to complete the roundup and load Jews onto the trucks. When the first salvo was heard from the woods, a terrible cry swept the marketplace as the collected Jews realized their fate. Thereafter, however, a quiet composure, indeed, in the words of German witnesses, an unbelievable and astonishing composure, settled over the Jews. If the victims were composed, the German officers grew increasingly agitated as it became clear that the pace of the executions was much too slow if they were to finish the job in one day. Comments were repeatedly made, such as, "It's not getting anywhere," and "It's not going fast enough." Trapp reached a decision and gave new orders. Third Company was called in from its outposts around the village to take over close guard of the marketplace. The men of Lieutenant Gnade's Second Company were informed that they too must now go to the woods to join the shooters. Sergeant Steinmetz of Third Platoon once again gave his men the opportunity to report if they did not feel up to it. No one took up his offer. Lieutenant Gnade divided his company into two groups assigned to different sections of the woods. He then visited Volov's First Company to witness a demonstration of the executions. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Scher and Sergeant Hergert took the First Platoon of Second Company, along with some men of Third Platoon, to a certain point in the woods. Scher divided his men into four groups, assigned them each a shooting area, and sent them back to fetch the Jews they were to kill. Lieutenant Gnade arrived and heatedly argued with Scher that the men were not being sent deep enough into the woods. By the time each group had made two or three round trips to the collection point and carried out their executions, it was clear to Scher that the process was too slow. He asked Hergert for advice. "I then made the proposal," Hergert recalled, "that it would suffice if the Jews were brought from the collection point to the place of execution by only two men of each group, while the other shooters of the execution commando would already have moved to the next shooting site. Furthermore, this shooting site was moved somewhat forward from execution to execution, and thus always got closer to the collection point on the forest path. We then proceeded accordingly." Hergert's suggestion speeded the killing process considerably. In contrast to First Company, the men of Second Company received no instruction on how to carry out the shooting. Initially, bayonets were not fixed as an aiming guide, and as Hergert noted, there was a considerable number of missed shots that led to the unnecessary wounding of the victims. One of the policemen in Hergert's unit likewise noted the difficulty the men had in aiming properly. "At first, we shot freehand. When one aimed too high, the entire skull exploded. As a consequence, brains and bones flew everywhere. Thus, we were instructed to place the bayonet point on the neck." According to Hergert, however, using fixed bayonets as an aiming guide was no solution. Through the point-blank shot that was thus required, the bullet struck the head of the victim at such a trajectory that often the entire skull, or at least the entire rear skull cap, was torn off, and blood, bone splinters, and brains sprayed everywhere and besmirched the shooters. Hergert was emphatic that no one in First Platoon was given the option of withdrawing beforehand. But once the executions began and men approached either him or Scher because they could not shoot women and children, they were given other duties. This was confirmed by one of his men. During the execution, word spread that anyone who could not take it any longer could report. He went on to note, "I myself took part in some 10 shootings in which I had to shoot men and women. I simply could not shoot people anymore, which became apparent to my sergeant, Hergert, because at the end I repeatedly shot past. For this reason, he relieved me. Other comrades were also relieved sooner or later because they simply could no longer continue." Lieutenant Drucker's 2nd Platoon and the bulk of Sergeant Steinmetz's 3rd Platoon were assigned to yet another part of the forest. Like Scher's men, they were divided into small groups of 5 to 8 each rather than large groups of 35 to 40, as in Volov's 1st Company. The men were told to place the end of their carbines on the cervical vertebrae at the base of the neck, but here too the shooting was done initially without fixed bayonets as a guide. The results were horrifying. The shooters were gruesomely besmirched with blood, brains, and bone splinters. It hung on their clothing. When dividing his men into small groups of shooters, Drucker had kept about a third of them in reserve. Ultimately, everyone was to shoot, but the idea was to allow frequent relief and cigarette breaks. With the constant coming and going from the trucks, the wild terrain, and the frequent rotation, the men did not remain in fixed groups. The confusion created the opportunity for work slowdown and evasion. Some men who hurried at their task shot far more Jews than others who delayed as much as they could. After two rounds, one policeman simply slipped off and stayed among the trucks on the edge of the forest. Another managed to avoid taking his turn with the shooters altogether. It was in no way the case that those who did not want to or could not carry out the shooting of human beings with their own hands could not keep themselves out of this task. No strict control was being carried out here. I therefore remained by the arriving trucks and kept myself busy at the arrival point. In any case, I gave my activity such an appearance. It could not be avoided that one or another of my comrades noticed that I was not going to the executions to fire away at the victims. They showered me with remarks, such as shithead and weakling, to express their disgust. But I suffered no consequences for my actions. I must mention here that I was not the only one who kept himself out of participating in the executions. By far the largest number of shooters at Josefov who were interrogated after the war came from the 3rd Platoon of 2nd Company. It is from them that we can perhaps get the best impression of the effect of the executions on the men and the dropout rate among them during the course of the action. Hans Dettelmann, a 40-year-old barber, was assigned by Drucker to a firing squad. It was still not possible for me to shoot the first victim at the first execution, and I wandered off and asked Lieutenant Drucker to be relieved. Dettelmann told his lieutenant that he had a very weak nature, and Drucker let him go. Walter Niehaus, a former Remtsma cigarette sales representative, was paired with an elderly woman for the first round. After I had shot the elderly woman, I went to Tony Bentheim, his sergeant, and told him that I was not able to carry out further executions. I did not have to participate in the shooting anymore. My nerves were totally finished from this one shooting. For his first victim, August Zorn was given a very old man. Zorn recalled that his elderly victim could not or would not keep up with his countrymen because he repeatedly fell and then simply lay there. I regularly had to lift him up and drag him forward. Thus, I only reached the execution site when my comrades had already shot their Jews. At the sight of his countrymen who had been shot, my Jew threw himself on the ground and remained lying there. I then cocked my carbine and shot him through the back of the head. Because I was already very upset from the cruel treatment of the Jews during the clearing of the town and was completely in turmoil, I shot too high. The entire back of the skull of my Jew was torn off and the brain exposed. Parts of the skull flew into Sergeant Steinmetz's face. This was grounds for me, after returning to the truck, to go to the first sergeant and ask for my release. I had become so sick that I simply couldn't anymore. I was then relieved by the first sergeant. Georg Kageler, a 37-year-old tailor, made it through the first round before encountering difficulty. After I had carried out the first shooting and at the unloading point was allotted a mother with daughter as victims for the next shooting, I began a conversation with them and learned that they were Germans from Kassel, and I took the decision not to participate further in the executions. The entire business was now so repugnant to me that I returned to my platoon leader and told him that I was still sick and asked for my release. Kageler was sent to guard the marketplace. Neither his pre-execution conversation with his victim nor his discovery that there were German Jews in Josefov was unique. Shimke, the man who had first stepped out, encountered a Jew from Hamburg in the marketplace, as did a second policeman. Yet another policeman remembered that the first Jew he shot was a decorated World War I veteran from Bremen who begged in vain for mercy. Franz Kastenbaum, who during his official interrogation had denied remembering anything about the killing of Jews in Poland, suddenly appeared uninvited at the office of the Hamburg State Prosecutor investigating Reserve Police Battalion 101. He told how he had been a member of a firing squad of 7 or 8 men that had taken its victims into the woods and shot them in the neck at point-blank range. This procedure had been repeated until the fourth victim. The shooting of the men was so repugnant to me that I missed the fourth man. It was simply no longer possible for me to aim accurately. I suddenly felt nauseous and ran away from the shooting site. I have expressed myself incorrectly just now. It was not that I could no longer aim accurately, rather that the fourth time I intentionally missed. I then ran into the woods, vomited, and sat down against a tree. To make sure that no one was nearby, I called loudly into the woods because I wanted to be alone. Today I can say that my nerves were totally finished. I think that I remained alone in the woods for some 2 to 3 hours. Kastenbaum then returned to the edge of the woods and rode an empty truck back to the marketplace. He suffered no consequences. His absence had gone unnoticed because the firing squads had been all mixed up and randomly assigned. He had come to make his statement, he explained to the investigating attorney, because he had had no peace since attempting to conceal the shooting action. Most of those who found the shooting impossible to bear quit very early, but not always. The men in one squad had already shot 10 to 20 Jews each when they finally asked to be relieved. As one of them explained, "I especially asked to be relieved because the man next to me shot so impossibly. Apparently, he always aimed his gun too high, producing terrible wounds in his victims. In many cases, the entire backs of victims' heads were torn off so that the brains sprayed all over. I simply couldn't watch it any longer." At the unloading point, Sergeant Bentheim watched men emerge from the woods covered with blood and brains, morale shaken and nerves finished. Those who asked to be relieved, he advised to slink away to the marketplace. As a result, the number of policemen gathered on the marketplace grew constantly. As with First Company, alcohol was made available to the policemen under Drucker and Steinmetz who stayed in the forest and continued shooting. As darkness approached at the end of a long summer day, and the murderous task was still not finished, the shooting became even less organized and more hectic. The forest was so full of dead bodies that it was difficult to find places to make the Jews lie down. When darkness finally fell about 9 p.m., some 17 hours after Reserve Police Battalion 101 had first arrived on the outskirts of Yusefov, and the last Jews had been killed, the men returned to the marketplace and prepared to depart for Biugoraj. No plans had been made for the burial of the bodies, and the dead Jews were simply left lying in the woods. Neither clothing nor valuables had been officially collected, though at least some of the policemen had enriched themselves with watches, jewelry, and money taken from the victims. The pile of luggage the Jews had been forced to leave at the marketplace was simply burned. Before the policemen climbed into their trucks and left Yusefov, a 10-year-old girl appeared, bleeding from the head. She was brought to Trapp, who took her in his arms and said, "You shall remain alive." When the men arrived at the barracks in Biugoraj, they were depressed, angered, embittered, and shaken. They ate little but drank heavily. Generous quantities of alcohol were provided, and many of the policemen got quite drunk. Major Trapp made the rounds, trying to console and reassure them, and again placing the responsibility on higher authorities. But neither the drink nor Trapp's consolation could wash away the sense of shame and horror that pervaded the barracks. Trapp asked the men not to talk about it, but they needed no encouragement in that direction. Those who had not been in the forest did not want to learn more. Those who had been there likewise had no desire to speak, either then or later. By silent consensus within Reserve Police Battalion 101, the Yusefov massacre was simply not discussed. The entire matter was a taboo. But repression during waking hours could not stop the nightmares. During the first night back from Yusefov, one policeman awoke firing his gun into the ceiling of the barracks. Several days after Yusefov, the battalion, it would seem, narrowly missed participation in yet another massacre. Units of 1st and 2nd Company, under Trapp and Volov, entered Alexandrov, a so-called street village composed of houses strung out along the road 12 kilometers west of Yusefov. A small number of Jews was rounded up, and both the policemen and the Jews feared that another massacre was imminent. After some hesitation, however, the action was broken off, and Trapp permitted the Jews to return to their houses. One policeman remembered vividly how individual Jews fell on their knees before Trapp and tried to kiss his hands and feet. Trapp, however, did not permit this and turned away. The policeman returned to Biugoraj with no explanation for the strange turn of events. Then on July 20th, precisely 1 month after its departure from Hamburg, and 1 week after the Yusefov massacre, Reserve Police Battalion 101 left Biugoraj for redeployment in the northern sector of the Lublin district.